Lincoln, Disc 30.
Lincoln was more troubled by the effect that his "To Whom It May Concern" letter had on the conservative elements of his following. It hit the war Democrats hardest. Charles D. Robinson, Democratic editor of the Green Bay, Wisconsin Advocate, best expressed their views. Up to now, despite sharp criticism from other Democrats, he'd sustained the president's war policy as the only method of putting down the rebellion. He'd even accepted the Emancipation Proclamation because he believed that depriving the Confederacy of its laborers weakened the rebels. But now, he lamented in a letter to Lincoln, "The requirement of the abandonment of slavery as a condition for peace talks puts the whole war question on a new basis and takes us war Democrats clear off our feet, leaving us no ground to stand upon." Recognizing that Robinson spoke for large numbers of war Democrats whose support for the National Union ticket was central to his re-election strategy, Lincoln felt compelled to draft a reply. Had he failed to insist on abolition as a condition for peace negotiations, he explained, he would be guilty of treachery to the hundreds of thousands of African Americans who'd come bodily over from the rebel side to ours. Such a betrayal couldn't escape the curses of heaven or of any good man. Apart from the moral issue, there was the practical consideration that without the physical force which the colored people now give and promise us, neither the present nor any coming administration can save the Union. But recognizing the genuineness of Robinson's concerns, the president also sought to soften his policy. Saying reunion and abandonment of slavery would be considered if offered is not saying that nothing else or less would be considered if offered, he suggested. If Jefferson Davis wishes to know what I would do if he were to offer peace and reunion, saying nothing about slavery, let him try me. The president's apparent willingness to modify his peace terms in order to hold the allegiance of the war Democrats was echoed the next day in the New York Times. Mr. Lincoln did say that he would receive and consider propositions for peace if they embraced the integrity of the Union and the abandonment of slavery. But he did not say that he would not receive them unless they embraced both these conditions. Lincoln decided to hold his letter to Robinson until he could discuss its contents with former Governor Alexander W. Randall and Judge Joseph T. Mills, both, like Robinson, from Wisconsin. As he talked to them, his impatience with the war Democrats became increasingly evident. If they really wanted to end the war without interfering with slavery, the field was open to them to have enlisted and put down this rebellion by force of arms long before the present policy was inaugurated. But now, if he followed their advice, he'd have to do without the help of nearly 200,000 black men in the service of the Union. In that case, we'd be compelled to abandon the war in 3 weeks. Practical considerations aside, there was the moral issue. How could anybody propose to return to slavery the black warriors of Port Hudson and Olustee to their masters to conciliate the South? I should be damned in time and in eternity for so doing, he told his visitors. The world shall know that I'll keep my faith to friends and enemies, come what will. That same afternoon, Lincoln tried his letter out on Frederick Douglass, the great African-American spokesman whom he considered one of the most meritorious men in America. When Douglas heard that the president would be willing to consider a peace plan that didn't include abolition, his eyes flashed in anger, and he strongly objected to the letter. "It would be given a broader meaning than you intend to convey," he warned. "It would be taken as a complete surrender of your anti-slavery policy and do you serious damage." Touched by Douglas's earnestness, and no doubt affected by his own eloquence in the interview with Randall and Mills, Lincoln put aside the letter to Robinson and never sent it. In effect, he gave up on winning the support of the War Democrats, most of whom quietly returned to their allegiance to the Democratic Party in the fall elections. Even more serious was the erosion of the president's support among conservative Republicans. These moderates didn't form a cohesive group, either in the Congress or in the country, and their opinions on issues like emancipation and Reconstruction covered a broad range. Most recognized that the end of slavery was inevitable, but were distressed that Lincoln had now chosen to make abolition a necessary condition for peace negotiations. Claiming to speak for the great body of the respectable part of the country, the New York merchant prince, William E. Dodge, wanted a peace that would be honorable to the North and so liberal to the South as to give the lie to the assertion that the North hated them and wished to destroy them. Lincoln's peace terms suggested that he was so fully committed to the entire abolition of slavery as a condition of peace that he'll use all the power of the government to continue the war till either the South is destroyed or they consent to give up the slaves. Many of the moderates were sure that the president's policy would strengthen the Confederate will to resist. More were troubled because the president's policy opened them to attack as abolitionists, miscegenationists, and amalgamationists. Had the war been moving toward a rapid conclusion, most of these fears could have been allayed. But in the late summer of 1864, disaster continued to follow disaster. On July 30th, after weeks of inactivity, Grant tried to break the defenses of Petersburg by exploding a huge mine under the Confederate line. 15,000 Union troops rushed into the crater produced by the explosion, but they were poorly led by drunken or incompetent officers, and within hours 4,000 men were killed or wounded, and the rest had to be withdrawn. Even before this fiasco, as losses in both the Army of the Potomac and in Sherman's army continued to mount, Lincoln had felt obliged to call for 500,000 more soldiers. If by September there were not enough volunteers, he would resort to a draft. This time, the draft was going to hit comfortable middle-class families because Congress had recently abolished the provision that had allowed a man to commute his military service by paying $300. Almost simultaneously, as the costs of the war grew steadily, Secretary of the Treasury Fessenden had to announce a new $200 million loan, and the credit of the government was now so poor that he had difficulty finding purchasers. Faced with all these problems, moderate Republicans rarely broke with the president, but they gave his reelection campaign only tepid support. In the cabinet itself, Attorney General Bates saw no alternative to Lincoln but felt that the country lacked direction and that our great want was a competent man at the head of affairs, a competent leader. Orville Browning felt even more alienated, and he wrote a fellow moderate, "You know, strange as it may seem to you, that I am personally attached to the president and have faithfully tried to uphold him and make him respectable, though I never have been able to persuade myself that he was big enough for his position. Still, I thought he might get through, as many a boy through college, without disgrace and without knowledge, and I fear he's a failure." In New York, disaffection among moderates posed a special problem for Lincoln because their leader, Thurlow Weed, was more critical of the president than ever. The New York boss was convinced that Lincoln went too far in making abolition a condition for peace negotiations. "As things now stand, Mr. Lincoln's re-election is an impossibility," he concluded. "The people are wild for peace," he explained to Seward. "They're told that the president will only listen to terms of peace on condition that slavery be abandoned. I'm fearful our hold upon Mr. Weed is slight," wrote Abram Wakeman, the New York postmaster, who was one of Lincoln's staunchest supporters. "He evidently has his eye upon some other probable candidate." Weed was indeed flirting with the Democrats. Though he said he would zealously support Lincoln if the Democrats nominated a peace man, he publicly offered his voice and vote to any presidential nominee who took as his platform the Crittenden Resolution of 1861, which declared that the sole object of the war was the preservation of the Union. As usual, Weed's disenchantment with the administration stemmed not merely from Lincoln's policies, but from his distribution of the patronage and public funds in New York. Chase's protege, Hiram Barney, remained the collector in the all-important customs house, though a moderate complained that he's a perfect negative man and possesses no knowledge of politics in any shape and makes no pretensions to such knowledge. Rufus F. Andrews, the surveyor, was a political adventurer from the start, who failed to support the regular nominees of the Republican Party. Other moderates alerted the president that there must be an immediate change in the offices of the collector and surveyor of the Port of New York. "The tide is setting strongly against us," Henry J. Raymond, chairman of the National Union Executive Committee, warned the president on August 22nd. Raymond had heard from Washburn that Illinois would go Democratic, from Cameron that Pennsylvania would be against Lincoln, and from Governor Morton that nothing but the most strenuous efforts can carry Indiana. He himself predicted that New York would give the Democratic candidate a majority of 50,000 votes. Some voters were complaining of the want of military successes. Others voiced fear and suspicion that we are not to have peace in any event under this administration until slavery is abandoned. Nothing but the most resolute and decided action on the part of the government and its friends, he told Lincoln, can save the country from falling into hostile hands. This message confirmed Lincoln's own pessimistic appraisal of the situation. "You think I don't know I'm going to be beaten?" he said to a friend. "But I do, and unless some great change takes place, badly beaten." On August 23rd, with Raymond's letter before him, he drafted and signed a memorandum. "This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be re-elected. Then it will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the Union between the election and the inauguration, as he'll have secured his election on such ground that he cannot possibly save it afterwards. Lincoln's language revealed not merely his pessimism about his own fortunes, but his realistic understanding of the forces that opposed his re-election. He didn't say that if he was defeated, the country would fall into the hands of Copperheads, who would consent to the division of the Union and the recognition of the Confederacy. He didn't think the Democrats were disloyal. There'd been much impugning of motives and much heated controversy as to the proper means and best mode of advancing the Union cause, he conceded. But he derived great satisfaction in recording that a great majority of the opposing party was as firmly committed as the Republicans to maintaining the integrity of the Union. And he noted with pride that no candidate for office whatever, high or low, has ventured to seek votes on the avowal that he was for giving up the Union. Nor did he have doubts about the loyalty of George B. McClellan, whose nomination by the Democrats he anticipated. But he did think that if the Democrats elected McClellan, the party platform would force the new administration to seek an armistice, which virtually assured Confederate independence. Folding and sealing his memorandum carefully, so that none of the text was visible, Lincoln put it aside until the next cabinet meeting, when he asked each member to sign his name on the back of the document. As he explained later, his purpose was to talk with McClellan, whose election he thought probable, saying, "General, the election has demonstrated that you are stronger, have more influence with the American people than I. Now let us together, you with your influence, and I with all the executive power of the government, try to save the country." He had little hope that McClellan would do anything, but he added, "At least I should have done my duty and have stood clear before my own conscience." Then, in the last days of August, with the assembling of the Democratic National Convention at Chicago, the outlook for Lincoln's re-election suddenly brightened. When he asked the newspaperman, Noah Brooks, to be his informal observer at the convention, the president predicted the outcome. "They must nominate a peace Democrat on a war platform, or a war Democrat on a peace platform. And I personally can't say that I care much which they do." The Democrats lived up to his expectations. Their platform announced that, after 4 years of failure to restore the Union by the experiment of war, justice, humanity, liberty, and the public welfare demand a cessation of hostilities, with a view to ending the war on the basis of the Federal Union of the States. It wasn't exactly a peace platform, for the Democrats, like the Republicans, were pledged to preserve the Union, but the condemnation of the war and the call for an end of fighting made it easy to brand the platform the Chicago Surrender. Then the convention nominated General George B. McClellan, the leading war Democrat, for president. The two wings of the Democratic Party had struck a bargain. The peace Democrats, most conspicuously represented by Vallandigham, dictated the platform, while their opponents named the presidential candidate. In effect, the Democrats chose to make party harmony their principal goal, even at the risk of defeat in the election. From all quarters, McClellan's friends warned that the platform was a wet blanket. Universally condemned, it had probably been concocted to destroy their candidate. After some delay, the general disavowed the peace plank. He could not look in the face of his gallant comrades of the Army and Navy, who've survived so many bloody battles, and tell them that their labors and the sacrifice of so many of our slain and wounded brethren had been in vain. But the damage was done. As one of McClellan's admirers said, his letter accepting the nomination of a party on whose platform he could not run amounted to twaddle and humbug. On September 4th, as if timed to make a mockery of the Democratic announcement that the war was a failure, came a message from Sherman. Atlanta is ours, and fairly won. After Jefferson Davis named the impetuous John Bell Hood as commander of the Confederate Army of Tennessee, replacing the capable Joseph E. Johnston, Sherman was able to put Atlanta under partial siege and force its evacuation. Almost simultaneously with Sherman's victory message, the North received the news that Rear Admiral David G. Farragut had captured Mobile, the last major Gulf port in Confederate hands. Joyfully, Lincoln proclaimed a day of thanksgiving and prayer for the signal success that divine providence has recently vouchsafed to the operations of the United States fleet and army in the harbor of Mobile, and the glorious achievements of the army under Major General Sherman, resulting in the capture of Atlanta. These Union victories, combined with the nomination of McClellan on a peace platform, had a devastating effect on the schemes of radical Republicans to replace Lincoln as their party's nominee. On August 30th, the day the Democrats chose McClellan, disaffected Republicans met, as scheduled, at David Dudley Field's house in New York City. But a number of major radical leaders were not present. Chase was absent. He now doubted the possibility of the success of the movement and advised his followers to support the regular Republican ticket. Wade recommended further deliberations before taking any action. Sumner remained in Boston, agreeing that Lincoln's nomination had been ill-considered and unseasonable. He thought there could be no alternative candidate unless he withdraws patriotically and kindly so as to leave no breach in the party. But the extreme radicals like Greeley, Henry Winter Davis, Field, Professor Francis Lieber of Columbia College, John Austin Stevens of the New York Union League, Park Godwin, Theodore Tilton and George Wilkes were in attendance, and they agreed that it was useless and inexpedient to attempt to run Mr. Lincoln. The group proposed that Lincoln should withdraw in favor of a new candidate. To prepare the ground for these moves, Greeley, Godwin, and Tilton agreed to send out letters to northern governors, asking whether Lincoln's election was a probability, whether he could carry their respective states, and whether the interests of the country required the substitution of another candidate in Lincoln's place. The answers they received showed how out of touch these radicals were with reality, how little they'd assimilated the consequences of McClellan's nomination, and how ill-prepared they were to deal with Sherman's victory. Even Governor Andrew of Massachusetts declined to endorse their program. Lincoln was essentially lacking in the quality of leadership, and his nomination had been a mistake, he granted. But now correction is impossible, and Massachusetts will vote for the Union cause at all events and will support Mr. Lincoln so long as he remains the candidate. The other governors were blunter. Richard Yates of Illinois wrote that substitution of another candidate for Lincoln would be disastrous in the highest degree. Governor James T. Lewis of Wisconsin told the editors, "In my judgment, the interests of the Union Party, the honor of the nation, and the good of mankind demand that Mr. Lincoln should be sustained and reelected. The conspiracy against Mr. Lincoln collapsed on Monday last, Thurlow Weed jubilantly wrote Seward on September 10th. Theodore Tilton suddenly discovered the Democrats' Chicago platform was the most villainous political manifesto known to American history, and that Sherman's victory at Atlanta had produced a sudden lighting up of the public mind. When he brought his Independent out for Lincoln, the Evening Post and even the Tribune followed suit. Presently, Greeley began making campaign speeches for the Republican ticket, though he made a point of not mentioning Lincoln by name. Kept closely informed of these activities, Lincoln moved to reunite his party, offering concessions to both factions. He had first to address the concerns of the conservatives, who continued to be alarmed by his insistence that abolition was a necessary condition for peace. Raymond, the chairman of the National Union Executive Committee, spoke for this group and claimed to represent the president's staunchest friends in every state. He pressed Lincoln to make a distinct offer of peace to Jefferson Davis, on the sole condition of acknowledging the supremacy of the Constitution, with all other questions, including emancipation, to be settled by a subsequent convention. Raymond was confident that the Confederates would reject such an offer, but by making it, Lincoln could rouse and concentrate the loyalty of the country and give us an easy and fruitful victory. Lincoln believed that such a scheme meant utter ruination, but he couldn't afford to dismiss Raymond's scheme out of hand. In late August, when the executive committee met in Washington, he had a long conversation with the editor and went so far as to draft possible instructions for a mission to Richmond. The emissary would be told to ignore the president's consistent refusal to speak of Jefferson Davis as president of the Confederate States of America, and to address him in any terms necessary to secure a conference. He should then propose that the war shall cease at once, all remaining questions to be left for adjustment by peaceful modes. If this was rejected, he should then inquire what terms of peace the Confederates would be willing to accept. When Raymond went over the draft, he realized what Lincoln had known all along, that his plan of sending a commission to Richmond would be worse than losing the presidential contest. It would be ignominiously surrendering it in advance. Persuaded, Raymond gave up diplomacy and went back to managing the campaign. And in a few days, the news from Chicago and Atlanta vindicated the president's position. It took something more than persuasion to allay the unhappiness of conservatives like Thurlow Weed. The president sent Nicolay to New York City to negotiate changes in the customs house that would placate the boss. It was, as the secretary said, a very delicate, disagreeable, and arduous duty, because the New York conservatives were no longer willing to share the patronage with the radicals. Yielding to necessity, Lincoln, with some reluctance, ousted Hiram Barney, the collector, on September 5th, and replaced him with Simeon Draper, a respected New York merchant who was an intimate of Seward and Weed. 10 days later, he removed Andrews, the surveyor of the port, another Chase supporter, and appointed in his stead Abram Wakeman, the New York City postmaster, who'd become an intimate friend of Mrs. Lincoln. Taking hold, Draper announced that he would hold everybody responsible for Mr. Lincoln's re-election, and I'll countenance nothing else. By making a few dismissals, he brought the rest of the Customs House gang in line. "It is remarkable to note," the New York Herald reported, "the change which has taken place in the political sentiments of some of these gentlemen within the last 48 hours. In fact, an anti-Lincoln man couldn't be found in any of the departments yesterday." Lincoln also had to enlist the support of the radicals, most of whom had not favored his renomination, and some of whom had been trying to replace him with another candidate. His task was made easier because many of the radicals had an institutional loyalty to the party they had helped found. Others made a cold-eyed calculation that they stood to benefit more from the victory of a Republican candidate whom they distrusted than from the success of any Democrat. He was fortunate that Zachariah Chandler, the blunt, self-educated Detroit businessman who represented Michigan in the Senate, took on himself the task of reconciling the radicals and the president. Though the Michigan senator thought poorly of Lincoln's record and believed he was perfectly infatuated with Seward and Blair, he was concerned for the victory of his party. "If it was only Abe Lincoln," he wrote to his wife, "I'd say go to hell in your own way." But now it was a choice between an inadequate Republican candidate and the traitor McClelland. During the final weeks of August, Chandler began exploring ways to bring Wade and Davis, the two radicals most openly critical of Lincoln, back into the regular Republican fold. Wade's resistance was the first to crack. He'd been overwhelmed by the hostile reception of the Wade-Davis manifesto, and his friends warned that Lincoln has been more firmly seated in the saddle than at any time since the premature action of the Baltimore Convention placed him there. Chandler persuaded him to swallow his pride and agree to endorse the Lincoln-Johnson ticket, provided that Davis did so too. Davis was also ready to negotiate. Distrusting Lincoln, he virulently hated Blair, leader of the rival Republican faction in Maryland. He agreed to support Lincoln, but only on condition that the president dismiss the Postmaster General from the cabinet. His purpose was not merely to kill off Blair, but to show Lincoln up as a mean and selfish old dog who sacrificed his friend to his prospects. Skillfully, Chandler presented Davis's demand not to Lincoln himself, but to his particular friends, those who drop in and chat with him of evenings, and who have his confidence. Probably he referred to men like Leonard Swett, John W. Forney, and Noah Brooks. As Davis scornfully reported, Chandler imbued the president's familiar spirits with the darkest views of Lincoln's prospects and sent them there night after night to regale him with some new tale of defection or threatened disaster. At the end of 8 days, according to Davis, who was not present, Lincoln was in the condition of a child frightened by ghost stories and ready to take refuge anywhere. In fact, Lincoln did not panic, and he resisted dismissing Blair in order to secure party unity and his own re-election. He had genuine respect for all the members of the Blair family. Francis P. Blair, Sr. had been a loyal conservative advisor throughout the war, and Frank Blair, after his intemperate attacks on the radicals in Congress, had displayed ability as a commander in Sherman's army. For Montgomery Blair, the president had real affection, and he was sure that Blair had made the best postmaster general that ever administered the department. But the postmaster general had become a controversial figure, more hated by the radicals than even Seward. His blunt denunciations of abolitionists, his continuing advocacy of the colonization of African Americans, his fierce opposition to radical schemes for Reconstruction, his zealous advocacy of Lincoln's renomination and reelection, all aroused hostility. So did his bitter and often unwarranted personal enmities. He carried on a bitter feud with Fremont. He hated Chase. He despised Halleck, and he could hardly bear to be in the same room as Stanton. Lincoln was distressed by the vindictiveness Blair demonstrated in his frequent quarrels, but as he told the senior Blair, he couldn't believe there was any profit to be expected on the sacrifice of a good and true friend from first to last for false ones. Chandler offered to sweeten the pot by suggesting that, in return for Blair's resignation, the president might secure not only the support of Wade and Davis, but the withdrawal of Fremont from the race. Though Fremont's campaign had been slipping, he retained a fiercely loyal following, especially among German Americans in the West, and the president feared he might siphon off enough votes to cost the Republicans Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri, and thus the election. The president, according to Chandler, was most reluctant to come to terms, but came. The senator then hot-footed it to New York to see Fremont. Establishing headquarters at the Astor House, Chandler met several times with Fremont, urging him, in the name of the president, the Union Congressional Committee, and the National Union Executive Committee, to consider withdrawing from a race in which his candidacy could only help elect McClellan. If Fremont agreed, Chandler promised that he would receive a new command as Major General in the Union Army, and that his old enemy, Blair, would be dismissed from the cabinet. Fremont took Chandler's offer under advisement and asked the opinion of his friends. He heard dissonant voices. Wendell Phillips urged him to continue his candidacy. A supporter in Pittsburgh begged him to come out as soon as practicable in favor of Lincoln and Johnson. After receiving assurance of Mr. Blair's immediate removal, and also Mr. Stanton's, and the assurance that Mr. Seward will not be reappointed. On September 17th, Gustav Paul Cluseret, the editor of Fremont's campaign newspaper, The New Nation, published an editorial supporting Lincoln, and warning readers that the general listened to any man who causes imaginary popular enthusiasm to glitter before his eyes, spends his money, profits by his natural indolence to cradle him in an illusion from which he will only awaken ruined in pocket and in reputation. That same day, Fremont decided to drop out of the race. Chandler wanted his withdrawal to be a conditional one to get Blair out. But Fremont honorably refused. "I will make no conditions. My letter's written and will appear tomorrow," he said. In a public letter, he announced that he was leaving the race not because he'd changed his opinion of Lincoln, whose administration has been politically, militarily, and financially a failure, but because McClellan would restore the Union with slavery. When the news of Fremont's withdrawal reached Washington, Lincoln, according to Davis, grew excited at the form of it and showed symptoms of flying from the bargain. But Chandler reminded him that, offensive as it was, Fremont's letter was a substantial advice to support Lincoln. Reluctantly, the president agreed to live up to the terms he'd agreed on. And on September 23rd, he asked for Blair's resignation. To take his place, he named former Governor William Dennison of Ohio, who was, as David Davis said, honorable, high-minded, pure, and dignified. While Blair's resignation was pending, both Wade and Henry Winter Davis took the stump in Lincoln's behalf. That left Salmon P. Chase and his followers as the final group of disgruntled Republicans who were still unwilling to endorse the re-election of the president. Nursing an ego bruised by his forced resignation from the cabinet, Chase had quietly encouraged moves to replace Lincoln on the Republican ticket. But in public, he assumed an air of disinterested statesmanship. He advised those who wrote him to accept Lincoln's renomination as decisive and to give him their support dutifully and manfully. But he told his correspondents not to publish his views. With the collapse of the anti-Lincoln movement in September, he warmed a little and recognized Lincoln and Johnson as nominees of the party whose principles and measures I fully accept. But he couldn't help adding wistfully, "We can't have everything as we'd wish." In late September, Chase began giving different political signals. Chief Justice Roger B. Taney was ailing. He was, after all, 87 years old. And his anticipated death raised a possibility that Chase had been more than once considered. Returning to Washington to consult with Fessenden on Treasury problems, he made a point of calling on Lincoln, and was quite cordially received. "But he's not at all demonstrative, either in speech or manner," Chase reported to his diary, adding the telling observation, "I feel that I do not know him." Shortly after this visit, he began to say positive things about Lincoln. "The best interests of the country require his re-election, and I shall give him my active support." Taney's death on October 12th made the naming of the next Chief Justice a public question. Sumner immediately urged Lincoln to appoint Chase, reminding the president that he had several times spoken of his former Treasury Secretary for this position. Chase's friend sent a barrage of letters to the White House backing his appointment. But there were other candidates. Attorney General Bates asked Lincoln for the appointment as a crowning, retiring honor of my life. Mrs. Stanton wanted her husband, exhausted by his demanding labors in the War Department, to be Chief Justice, and she enlisted Browning to urge his case with Lincoln. Dozens of letters recommended elevating Noah Swain, the anti-slavery corporate lawyer whom Lincoln had named an Associate Justice in 1862. William M. Everts, the careful New York lawyer, had his supporters. Francis P. Blair Sr. earnestly implored Lincoln to appoint his son Montgomery, to remove the cloud which his ostracism from your cabinet had caused. Lincoln listened and read, but took no action. He'd probably decided to name Chase, but, as he told Nicolay, he was resolved to be very shut pan about this matter. Eager for the appointment, Chase wrote the president a friendly letter about Republican prospects in Ohio. Without reading it, Lincoln directed, "File it with his other recommendations." As the president failed to act, Sumner's urgency grew greater, and he persuaded Chase to write a letter that he could show Lincoln. "It is perhaps not exactly en règle, to say what one will do in regard to an appointment not tendered to him, but it's certainly not wrong to say to you that I should accept." Chase went on to add words that must have choked him. "Happily, it's now certain that the next administration will be in the hands of Mr. Lincoln, from whom the world will expect great things." Still, Lincoln did not name a Chief Justice. Finally, getting the cue, Chase took to the stump, urging rallies at Louisville, Lexington, St. Louis, Cleveland, Detroit, and Chicago to vote for Lincoln's re-election. It was all just as the New York Herald had wickedly anticipated in August. Now the sorehead Republicans, as the paper called the dissident radicals, were all skedaddling for the Lincoln train and selling out at the best terms they can. The Herald had predicted that the ultra-radical, ultra-shoddy, and ultra-nigger soreheads will all make tracks for Old Abe's plantation and will soon be found crowing and blowing and vowing and writing and swearing and stumping the states on his side, declaring that he and he alone is the hope of the nation. As Chase canvassed the West, he reflected on a conversation he'd had some weeks earlier with a New Yorker who thought Lincoln very wise, observing that if he were more radical, he would have offended conservatives, if more conservative, the radicals. Wonderingly, Chase asked himself, "Will this be the judgment of history?" "I cannot run the political machine," Lincoln was quoted as saying during the campaign. "I have enough on my hands without that. It's the people's business." He didn't take part in any of the hundreds of campaign marches and torchlight processions staged by the National Union Republican Party throughout the North. He was not involved in the work of the Loyal Publication Societies, headed by Francis Lieber in New York and by John Murray Forbes in Boston, which distributed more than 500,000 Union pamphlets bearing titles like "No Party Now, But All for Our Country." He did nothing to encourage partisan newspapers that attacked the Democrats as copperheads, or charged that they were engaged in a peace party plot. Indeed, he discounted tales of copperhead conspiracies as puerile. Nor did Lincoln take public notice of the attacks Democrats made on him during the campaign. He didn't comment on Democratic rallies where partisans carried banners reading "Time to Swap Horses, November 8th, or "No More Vulgar Jokes." He probably never saw scurrilous Democratic pamphlets like "The Lincoln Catechism," wherein the eccentricities and beauties of despotism are fully set forth, which called him "Abraham Africanus the First," and quoted the first of the president's own 10 commandments, "Thou shalt have no other god but the Negro." The repeated Democratic charge that he and the Republicans favored intermarriage of blacks and whites, Lincoln acknowledged only indirectly, joking that miscegenation was a Democratic mode of producing good Union men, and I don't propose to infringe on the patent. He didn't respond to Democratic charges raised in as respectable a journal as the New York World, that his administration was characterized by ignorance, incompetency, and corruption. Though he was, as Mrs. Lincoln said, almost a monomaniac on the subject of honesty, he didn't refute the charge that he helped a relative defraud the quartermaster's department in St. Louis. Only once was he tempted to reply to a personal attack. Democratic newspapers now revived the canard that while touring the Antietam battlefield in September 1862, He'd asked Ward Lehman to sing a comic Negro song. They claimed that such behavior demonstrated that he was not fit for any office of trust, or even for decent society. Belligerently, Lehman attempted to refute the slander, but Lincoln, thinking it would be better simply to state the facts, wrote out his own account of how he had, indeed, days after the battle and far from the soldiers' cemetery, asked Lehman to sing a little sad song. Then he told Lehman not to publish his reply, saying, "I dislike to appear as an apologist for an act of my own which I know was right." Lincoln's public appearances during the campaign were rare. In June, he did attend the Great Central Sanitary Fair held in Philadelphia to raise money for the Sanitary Commission and other groups providing for the needs of the soldiers, but he said little. "I do not really think it's proper in my position for me to make a political speech," he told a group at the Hotel Continental. "And being more of a politician than anything else, I'm without anything to say." When volunteer regiments on their way home, as their terms of enlistment expired, came by the White House, he thanked them for their service and said nothing more partisan than that they should rise up to the height of a generation of men worthy of a free government. But if Lincoln didn't take a public role in the campaign, he was intimately involved in all the details of behind-the-scenes management. Indeed, as Fessenden remarked, "The president's too busy looking after the election to think of anything else." Repeatedly, he intervened to end party squabbling. In Pennsylvania, for example, antagonism between the Cameron and Curtin factions was so great that, as Lincoln was told, it produced distraction and indifference, which may possibly be fatal. Cameron seemed to be conducting the campaign primarily with a view to his own election to the Senate, while Governor Curtin was so disaffected that he predicted the re-election of this administration is going to send us to hell. Lincoln summoned the Pennsylvania governor with his aide Alexander K. McClure to the White House and used all his personal powers of persuasion to get his people to work with the Cameron forces until after the election. The president intervened in congressional contests when local feuds among Republicans threatened to affect the outcome of the election. In New York, a group of conservative Republicans was working to defeat the election of Roscoe Conkling, the party's nominee for Congress. When Conkling's friends asked Lincoln's assistance, he replied with a strong letter, "I'm for the regular nominee in all cases, and no one could be more satisfactory to me as the nominee in that district than Mr. Conkling." Again, when he learned that the postmaster of Philadelphia was using his influence to defeat Representative William D. Kelly, he summoned the official to Washington and told him bluntly, "I'm well satisfied with Judge Kelly as a member of Congress, and I don't know that the man who might supplant him would be as satisfactory." The postmaster could vote for whom he chose, but he must not constrain any of his subordinates to do other than as he thinks fit. Lincoln recognized the influence that newspapers had on public opinion, and he tried to enlist the support of prominent editors. He even went so far as to approach the notorious James Gordon Bennett, whose New York Herald had yet to take a public position on the election. Because the circulation and influence of the Herald were so great, Lincoln's New York friend suggested that it might be worthwhile to woo the editor with flattery. They knew that Bennett, whose reputation for immorality was as well-deserved as his paper's reputation for scandal, longed for respectability. When they approached him, the canny editor asked bluntly, "Will I be a welcome visitor at the White House if I support Mr. Lincoln?" The president may have shared John Hay's conviction that Bennett was too pitchy to touch, and he initially offered only a vague promise that whoever aids the right will be appreciated and remembered after the election. Bennett responded that the offer didn't amount to much. When intermediaries began to explore the possibility that Lincoln might offer Bennett an appointment as American minister to France, the tone of the Herald toward the administration became notably kinder. Bennett didn't endorse Lincoln, telling a go-between to say to the president that puffs did no good and he could accomplish most for you by not mentioning your name. But the bitterness of his attacks on Lincoln diminished. Though he continued to call Lincoln a failure, he termed McClellan no less a failure, though a failure perhaps in a less repulsive way. And in the end, the Herald endorsed neither candidate. After the election, Lincoln paid the price for Bennett's neutrality by offering the editor the French ministry, which he knew he would decline. But there were limits to what Lincoln would do to secure a second term. He didn't even consider canceling or postponing the election. Even had that been constitutionally possible, the election was a necessity. "We cannot have free government without elections," he explained. "And if the rebellion could force us to forego or postpone a national election, it might fairly claim to have already conquered and ruined us." He didn't postpone the September draft call, even though Republican politicians from all across the North entreated him to do so. Because Indiana failed to permit its soldiers to vote in the field, he was entirely willing to furlough Sherman's regiments so that they could go home and vote in the October state elections. But he made a point of telling Sherman, "They need not remain for the presidential election, but may return to you at once." Though it was clear that the election was going to be a very close one, Lincoln didn't try to increase the Republican electoral vote by rushing the admission of new states like Colorado and Nebraska, both of which would surely have voted for his reelection. On October 31st, in accordance with an act of Congress, he did proclaim Nevada a state, but he showed little interest in the legislation admitting the new state. Despite the suspicion of both Democrats and radicals, he made no effort to force the readmission of Louisiana, Tennessee, and other southern states, partially reconstructed but still under military control, so that they could cast their electoral votes for him. He reminded a delegation from Tennessee that it was the Congress, not the chief executive, that had the power to decide whether a state's electoral votes were to be counted, and announced firmly, "Except it be to give protection against violence, I decline to interfere in any way with any presidential election." Both what Lincoln did in the campaign of 1864 and what he refrained from doing reflected his sense of the importance of this election. In part, as he admitted, he sought a second term out of personal vanity or ambition. "I confess that I desired to be reelected," he said frankly. "God knows I don't want the labor and responsibility of the office for another 4 years. But I have the common pride of humanity to wish my past 4 years' administration endorsed." Honestly believing that he could better serve the nation in its need and peril than any new man could possibly do, he wanted the opportunity to finish this job of putting down the rebellion and restoring peace and prosperity to the country. His wife wanted a second term at least as much as he did. To Mary Lincoln, re-election meant not merely vindication of her husband, but escape from her own personal difficulties. After Willie's death, she had largely given up on refurbishing the White House and had turned to decorating and ornamenting herself. She went deeply into debt, purchasing clothing and jewelry from New York and Philadelphia merchants, such as a white point lace shawl valued at $2,000, a pearl and diamond ring, an onyx breastpin with earrings, and two diamond and pearl bracelets. David Davis heard a rumor that she purchased 300 pairs of kid gloves from a Washington merchant. "I must dress in costly materials," she explained to Elizabeth Keckley, her dressmaker. "The people scrutinize every article that I wear with critical curiosity. The very fact of having grown up in the West subjects me to more searching observation." Convinced that her appearance was helping her husband's bid for re-election, she also saw victory in November as a means of postponing a reckoning of her debts, which Lincoln didn't know about. "If he's re-elected," she told Mrs. Keckley, "I can keep him in ignorance of my affairs. But if he's defeated, then the bills will be sent in, and he'll know all." Lincoln believed that there was more than personal satisfaction at stake in the 1864 election. He saw it as a test of the feasibility of democratic government. The will of the people was the ultimate law for all. If the people supported the Union cause, he said, they would act for the best interests of their country and the world, not only for the present, but for all future ages. If, on the other hand, they should deliberately resolve to have immediate peace, even at the loss of their country and their liberty, I know not the power or the right to resist them. It's their own business, and they must do as they please with their own. The decision they made would determine the weal or woe of this great nation. This view of the 1864 election was shared by many Americans, including some who hadn't hitherto been notably warm toward the Lincoln administration. Most African Americans hoped and prayed for Lincoln's re-election, even though few of them were allowed to vote. A few black spokesmen were reluctant to support this fickle-minded man who'd been reluctant to announce emancipation, slow to enroll Negro troops, unwilling to fight for equal pay for blacks who did enlist, and publicly silent on Negro voting, and some, like Frederick Douglass, initially favored Fremont. But when the election narrowed to a choice between Lincoln and McClellan, African Americans saw their duty clearly. At the National Convention of Colored Men, held in Syracuse in October, the black Massachusetts lawyer John S. Rock put the choice concisely. "There are but two parties in the country today. The one headed by Lincoln is for freedom and the Republic, and the other, by McClellan, is for despotism and slavery." Impressive as were the endorsements of such black leaders, Lincoln may have gained more solace from individual African Americans who spoke only for themselves. Early in 1864, his old acquaintance, William de Fleurville, Billy the Barber, wrote from Springfield, hoping that Lincoln would be re-elected because then the oppressed will shout the name of their deliverer and generations to come will rise up and call you blessed. Late in October, the president had a visit from Sojourner Truth, the elderly black woman who, after having been sold 3 times on the auction block, escaped to freedom and afterward brought out other fugitives on the Underground Railroad. She declared that she never was treated by anyone with more kindness and cordiality, and she was proud that the president wrote in her autograph book, "With the same hand that signed the death warrant of slavery." "I felt that I was in the presence of a friend," the old woman said, "and I now thank God from the bottom of my heart that I always advocated his cause." Though abolitionists had often been sharply critical of Lincoln, a majority of the reformers now favored his reelection. Earlier in the year, the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society was shattered after a debate between its 2 most notable leaders, Wendell Phillips, who announced that Lincoln had no commitment to liberty and was knowingly preparing for a peace in disregard for the Negro, and William Lloyd Garrison, who countered that the president had shown great capacity for growth and had moved as fast as public opinion allowed. In the months that followed, Phillips became one of the most conspicuous supporters of Fremont's candidacy and vowed that he would cut off both hands before doing anything to aid Abraham Lincoln's election, while Garrison insisted that if Lincoln had made mistakes, 1,000 incidental errors and blunders are easily to be borne with on the part of him who, at one blow, severed the chains of 3,300,000 slaves. The quarrel splintered the abolitionist movement, but Garrison and his followers retained control of the 2 most important periodicals, The Liberator and the Anti-Slavery Standard, both of which gave consistent support to Lincoln's campaign. Garrison himself attended the National Union Convention in Baltimore, and afterward he had 2 long interviews with the president. Much pleased with his spirit and the familiar and candid way in which he unbosomed himself, the veteran abolitionist was more confident than ever of Lincoln's desire to uproot slavery and give fair play to the emancipated. The support the president received from Protestant religious groups was overwhelming. He'd made a point of consulting religious leaders and of praising their contribution to the war effort. In May, when a delegation from the Methodist Episcopal Church pointed out the denomination's record for loyalty and support of the administration, he replied, "God bless the Methodist Church, bless all the churches, and blessed be God, who in this our great trial giveth us the churches." The same month, he offered thanks to the American Baptist Home Mission Society for the effective and almost unanimous support which the Christian communities are so zealously giving to the country and to liberty. Now they returned the compliment. Methodist Bishop Gilbert Haven announced the church's duty of the hour was to march to the ballot box, an army of Christ, with the banners of the cross, and deposit, as she can, 1,000,000 votes for her true representative, and she will give the last blow to the reeling fiend. As the Christian Advocate and Journal observed, "There probably never was an election in all our history into which the religion element entered so largely, and nearly all on one side." Northern men and women of letters also endorsed Lincoln's reelection with unprecedented unanimity. Mostly from the Northeast, these writers initially viewed Lincoln with skepticism, thinking him an uncouth, uneducated frontiersman who was certainly not a gentleman, and his hesitant course on slavery had reinforced their suspicions. But their appreciation of the difficulties the president faced and of the skill with which he handled them had grown. And now, faced with a choice between McClellan and Lincoln, virtually all supported the Union candidate. Ralph Waldo Emerson was not active in politics, but he shared Lincoln's view of the significance of the election. "Seldom in history," he said, "was so much staked on a popular vote. I suppose never in history." "We breathe freer," Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote, when he felt confident that the president would have a second term. "The country will be saved." Harriet Beecher Stowe was a firm supporter of Lincoln. She remembered how kindly the president had received her in the White House back in 1862, when, according to a family story, he exclaimed, "So this is the little lady who made this big war." She defended Lincoln from irresponsible attacks, remarking, "Even the ass can kick safely and joyfully at the lion in a net." Though John Greenleaf Whittier preferred Fremont, he was happy enough to see all loyal men rallying in favor of Lincoln, and exclaimed, "Between him and that traitor platform of the Democrats, who could hesitate?" With great pleasure, Edward Everett agreed to be one of the Massachusetts Republican electors, pledged to vote for Lincoln as an entirely conscientious and eminently kind-hearted man, who had administered the government with the deepest sense of responsibility to his country and his God. None of Lincoln's literary supporters was more loyal or more influential than James Russell Lowell, one of the editors of the North American Review. The four long articles he published in 1864 amounted to an extended argument in favor of Lincoln's reelection. The final one, "The Next General Election," which appeared on the eve of the election, ridiculed Democratic talk of conciliating the Confederates and praised Lincoln as a long-headed and long-purposed man who'd shown from the first the considerate wisdom of a practical statesman.
This ends Disc 30.